Having seen that the history of infant baptism cannot be traced further back than about the close of the 2nd century, we feel no disposition to pursue it into later periods, being content to know that it did not originate in the days of the apostles, or have their sanction. This we have seen as surely as there is truth in the testimony of those who practice it. The reader will please remember that we have found its origin not in the identity of the Jewish and the Christian churches, not in Jewish circumcision, not in Jewish proselyte baptism, not in the teaching of John the Baptist, Christ, or the apostles, but in the absurd dogma of infantile depravity or the inherited guilt of Adam's sin. So testifies Tertullian, so testifies Origen, and all the primitive fathers who give testimony on the subject. My distinguished friend Mr. Ditzler says, "They all believed that infants were depraved, as their writings show. They believed that baptism was regeneration in the sense of washing away original sin. That infants were depraved by original sin and could not be saved without this washing away of that sin. And therefore they baptized infants that they might be saved." Now, the apostolic fathers speak in this manner and refer to the baptism of infants. Louisville Debate, page 163. This is a frank admission of what is unquestionably true, limiting the words apostolic fathers to such as wrote after the introduction of the practice. But we have later testimony than the so-called apostolic fathers on this subject. In a work titled Doctrinal Tracts, page 251, we find the following paragraph in a treatise on baptism. "As to the grounds of it, if infants are guilty of original sin, then they are proper subjects of baptism, seeing in the ordinary way they cannot be saved unless this be washed away in baptism. It has been already proved that this original stain cleaves to every child of man, and that hereby they are children of wrath and liable to eternal damnation." This work was published by Lane and Scott, New York, 1850, by order of the General Conference of the Methodist Church. Hence, the above paragraph comes to us endorsed by the Methodist Church through her General Council only 23 years ago, and it clearly shows that infant baptism in the judgment of that organization was based upon the doctrine of original sin or inherited guilt, by reason of which infants are children of wrath and liable to eternal damnation, and in the ordinary way cannot be saved unless this original sin be washed away by baptism. This tract was published for about 30 years by the General Council as the production of Mr. Wesley's pen, but Mr. Jackson, the biographer of Mr. Wesley, denies that he wrote it. So far as the weight of its authority goes, it matters little whether Mr. Wesley wrote it or not. It was written by someone of no ordinary power, as the tract itself shows, and the fact that it was published by order of the General Conference gives it more authority than it could derive from Mr. Wesley or any other one man. But we do not regard Mr. Jackson's denial as quite sufficient to show that it was not written by Mr. Wesley. Of all writers known to us as a class, biographers are least reliable. It is a well-known fact that they ignore and often cover up the faults and exaggerate the virtues of their heroes. And when we add to this the fact that Mr. Jackson's partisan feelings would incline him to mold Mr. Wesley's teaching in accordance with his own views and the interest of his church, we are inclined to accept his denial under the circumstances with some degree of caution. What are the circumstances connected with the publication of this tract? In the advertisement following the title page, it is shown that a number of tracts had been published with the discipline for a time, but in 1812 the General Conference ordered them left out of the discipline and published in a separate volume. Following this announcement, it is said, "Several new tracts are included in this volume, and Mr. Wesley's short treatise on baptism is substituted in the place of the extract from Mr. Edwards on that subject." Here it is stated that the former tract by Mr. Edwards was taken out and this one by Wesley was put in. Did those who make this statement tell the truth, or were they mistaken in what they said? On page 249 we find a footnote as follows, quote, "that Mr. Wesley, as a clergyman of the Church of England, was originally a high churchman in the fullest sense is well known. When he wrote this tract in the year 1756, he seems still to have used some expressions in relation to the doctrine of baptismal regeneration, which we at this day should not prefer. Some such, in the judgment of the reader, may perhaps be found under this second head. The last sentence, however, contains a guarded corrective. It explains also the sense in which we believe Mr. Wesley intended much of what goes before to be understood. Unquote. As no name is attached to this note, we know not who wrote it, but we suppose it was by the publishing committee. Be this as it may, it seems to have been written by someone acquainted with the facts, for it even gives the date when Mr. Wesley wrote the tract. This note, be it remembered, is attached to the tract itself. The whole Methodist Conference, publishers, publishing committee, and everybody else connected with this tract, save Mr. Jackson, were mistaken for 30 years, or Mr. Wesley wrote it. No child ever resembled its father more than does the style of this tract resemble the general style of Mr. Wesley's writings. But if those who practice infant baptism intend to repudiate the doctrine that infants are in danger of being lost unless baptized, we trust they will cease abusing us for opposing their baptism. If those who are unbaptized are in no more danger than those baptized, why abuse us for seeking to prevent that which can do no good? Surely they do not wish to unjustly prejudice the minds of the people against us by making much ado about nothing. If infants need not baptism, why baptize them? We think they are good enough without baptism. Jesus said, "Of such is the kingdom of heaven." Not of such as they will be when they are baptized, but of such as they are without baptism. But we are referred to the baptism of the Israelites in the cloud and sea as a clear case of the baptism of infants. All our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 and 2. It is certain that infants were under the cloud and passed through the sea, hence it is insisted that they were in the typical baptism referred to by Paul, and should now be baptized to fill the antitype. Does the fact that they were under the cloud and in the sea prove that they were contemplated by Paul in the baptism referred to? If so, then the flocks and herds of the Hebrews were included also, for it is just as certain that they were under the cloud and in the sea as it is that the infants were there. Shall we baptize our flocks, therefore, to fill the antitype? Why not? They were taken along without their volition, just as were the infants. Hence, if these were baptized, why not those? Paul says that those baptized did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Verses 3 and 4. Thus we see that those contemplated by Paul were capable of receiving spiritual instruction concerning Christ, which Paul calls spiritual meat and drink. Hence, he says, by faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, which the Egyptians essaying to do were drowned. Hebrews 11, verse 29. Is it not clear that Paul did not contemplate infants, but alluded to such as could receive spiritual instruction and pass through by faith? Infant baptism was never heard of in Paul's day. Hence, when he spake of baptized persons, either in type or antitype, he contemplated only such as were legitimate subjects of the rite. Suppose we try the commission by the same principle of interpretation applied to the baptism of the Israelites. Jesus said, "Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." Now it is just as certain that infants were creatures in the world as it is that they were under the cloud and passed through the sea. Were they contemplated in the commission? If so, what next? He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned. Infants cannot believe, therefore they must all be damned. Is anyone prepared to accept the conclusion? Surely not. Yet it is fairly deducible from the commission by the same rules applied to the baptism of the Israelites to prove infant baptism. Infants are not subjects of gospel address and were not contemplated in the commission, nor are they subjects of baptism. Hence, they were not contemplated by Paul. Baptism is not a mere unmeaning ceremony, but a solemn act of obedience to God. Gentle reader, have you intelligently submitted to his will in the act required of you? Jesus commanded the apostles to teach the nations, baptizing them, the taught, clearly implying that they should baptize none but the taught. We have seen that they, acting under this commission, preached the gospel to the people, and when they believed it, they were baptized, both men and women. Intelligent, believing, penitent men and women who desire salvation should be baptized into the sublime names of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. None others should be so baptized, for it would do them no good. And should it unfortunately keep them from obeying God in mature years, it would do them much harm. In vain may we attempt the worship of God by obeying the commandments of men. Be baptized yourself. You cannot obey God for your children, but you can bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, and when they are old enough to understand the Lord's will have the consolation of seeing them obey it for themselves. End of chapter 13.